I conducted an interview with Rob Prince about French neocolonialism in Northern Africa, particularly in Mali. However, the audio didn't come out so well. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read his parts and post my parts. And so that will be the interview with Rob Prince. However, it will be my voice for both parts. Okay, on with me from Colorado to Japan is Mr. Rob Prince, the publisher of the Colorado Progressive Jewish News and a lecturer for the University of Denver. And the last time we spoke was back in February, nearly a year ago, when the French went into Mali again. But let's rewind a bit because you wrote a nice timeline there on your blog. Why did France originally invade Mali, Rob Prince? Well, there are two rationales. There's the official rationale, and you know, one can take that with two or three grains of salt. And then there are the probable strategic reasons. So the official rationale, which was stated on several occasions by the French President François Hollande, was essentially that France was going in for completely humanitarian reasons to stop, it wasn't called a slaughter, but an Islamic fundamentalist takeover, and that France had no economic or strategic interest there. That was, as I call it, a very touching explanation, but one that does not meet any standards of truth or accuracy. Back to Ryan Dawson. Now, but the French say that their presence is only for humanitarian purposes. But how well did that, I mean, that's obviously baloney, but how well did that fly in France? Did they believe it? Rob Prince. You know, there's a contradiction in France. I wouldn't overstate the level to which the country is democratic, but still, there are democratic institutions and all that, but if you contrast that with France's role in Africa, it's quite striking. France's history going back to the colonial period and post-colonial period is one of economic and political exploitation, really to an extreme level, quite frankly. The comparison that I would make for people who might not be familiar with the situation is France's role there is similar to the U.S.'s role in Central and South America. Very similar in terms of how it works. So the other explanation for why France is there, Mali is a strategic country. In fact, the entire Sahara region are countries that are not very well known. What are we talking about? We're talking about Mauritania, we're talking about Mali, we're talking about the southern regions of Algeria, we're talking about Niger, we're talking about Chad, and to a certain extent, the Sudan. And that's going from west to east. Those regions were explored in the 1950s by French geologists and scientists. It was found even then, 60 years ago, to be resource-rich. What are we talking about? Well, of course, oil and natural gas in some places, but other minerals too. Gold. Mali produces gold. In Africa, it's one of the biggest gold producers. Uranium in Niger. And right now, in northern regions of Mali, there's a kind of peninsula. It's a peninsula in that it follows the borders and connects Mauritania, Algeria, and northern Mali. And in that area, there's a frantic hunt for oil in which
French, Algerian, I think American companies are involved. So we're talking about a region that has great strategic importance. There's a second element I would give to the Mali situation, and that is the country just east of Mali is Niger. And Niger is, if I'm not mistaken, it's Africa's largest producer of uranium. Most of that uranium is controlled by an enormous French mining company, which is called Areva, A-R-E-V-A. And the biggest of these mines in Niger, these uranium mines in Niger, are quite close to the Malian border in the northern region. So there was great concern on the part of the French that if there was a change of political leadership in the northern regions of Mali, that its uranium interests would be threatened. So there are sizable, substantial interests that France has in Mali, and to say that they're not a factor in this French military incursion into Mali is complete. It's just silliness. Again, it was like pablum. It's just not true.
Right. Now, but why do you think the lie sold so easily in France? Oh, you know, it's very difficult for people in a country, whether it's France or the United States, to really figure out what's going on halfway around the world. So take the United States when the U.S. went into Iraq in 2003. And at first, even though it was already rather clear that the pretexts for going to war were all fallacious, they were untrue, yet the media and the government was able to convince people that somehow this was all a good thing. More or less, if you look at the French media, they are complicit in painting a picture of a benign, caring France that simply wants to help the development of its former African colonies. People fall for it. I can't explain it much more than that, but it's rather typical. We see it here and we see it in other countries. I suppose the really key thing here is, what is it that cannot be said? What cannot be said is, if you like, the truth. We are going in to protect an important mineral/energy resource, and our real fear is that if we don't, the Chinese or somebody else will get it. Well, you know, you're asking French soldiers to die for their big company. Was the United States, when we went into Iraq, asking people to die for ExxonMobil? So you need a pretext. Ryan Dawson.
Right.
Rob Prince. And there's some other things that are necessary, the sense that if you don't go in, some horrible thing is going to happen on the ground. So let me make a comparison, and I'm looking now at the Central African Republic, where things are in turmoil. If we go back just a little bit, let's remember what the pretext was for going after Gaddafi in Libya. The pretext was that if the United Nations didn't approve military action in Libya, that Gaddafi was going to slaughter the population of Benghazi. Well, that was quite an assumption. I have a feeling he wouldn't have been very nice, but the notion that we are looking at genocide or mass murder in Benghazi was completely swallowed by Western media, if you like, and that was the pretext. Well, what was the pretext for the case in Mali? The pretext was that evil Islamic fundamentalists, if they weren't stopped now, that they would assault the Malian capital. They are on the edge of Bamako. Well, the interesting thing was, at the time that the French military went in, number one, the rebels were 600 miles away from Bamako. Secondly, and as we say in Yiddish, at least when it happened, among those rebels, the Islamic elements had taken over. They were kind of Meshugana. There was a kind of Nazi element. But they were only 3,000 or 4,000 of them. That was it. That's it. So you're saying 3,000 or 4,000 rebels who need to come 600 miles are going to be able to seize a city of 1.5 million? So you begin to look at the pretext, and it doesn't add up. Well, we're here, let's say, in Paris, Denver, or Tokyo. We don't see those things so clearly. So the pretext work long enough to give the excuse for military intervention. What are we hearing in the Central African Republic? Look, which is a whole nother subject, though related. What are we hearing is that if we don't accept military intervention, we're going to have a repeat Rwanda. I'm trying to get a better handle on what is happening there, but looking at the pretext for Libya and Mali, I have some real serious questions about what France is doing there. Ryan Dawson.
Well, let me touch on what you went over first for a little bit. And for one, for Paul Kagame in Rwanda, 40% of his budget is coming from the U.S. and U.K. anyway. But I think what the comparison you made to the pretext for Iraq are actually very similar, because one of the pretexts is that we were fed, of course, there's weapons of mass destruction and all that, but one of the myths was that the U.S. needed to go in to liberate the Kurds, which was totally disingenuous and didn't happen. And I think that for Mali, the Tuareg or Azawad, or I'm not sure which one is proper to say, but they're a little bit like the Kurds or maybe Palestinians in that they've also been victims of arbitrary Western border drawing.
Rob Prince. You're right. You're right in the validity of the comparison. I don't think it matters. They call themselves both. Their formal name is Azawad. You're right about that. They are known as Tuareg. They have kind of accepted that term. But getting away from that, this was the people who, in the colonial period already, their region was divided arbitrarily into four countries if you look at the lines. They're divided, and at least from an ethnic point of view, they have no clear nation. So yes, that's the same situation for the Kurds, that's the situation for the Palestinians. That's the situation, quite frankly, for hundreds of ethnic groups in Africa who find themselves imprisoned by borders that were created mostly by the French and the British in the colonial period. So yes, they are caught in this web. And they have, well, their history is really kind of complex. On the one hand, they really do have legitimate issues. They are unquestionably what one might call an oppressed minority within Mali, both economically, culturally, and socially. They are looked down upon. There's very little investment in the north from the central government. Their voice in Bamako, the national capital, is non-existent. And the result is that they have rebelled. There have been at least three major rebellions. If you look carefully, you see that the rebellions went on almost nonstop. I can count six, at least six. Basically, they are rebelling every 10 years. Every decade, there is a rebellion. One promising one was in 1992. It appeared that they were going to be given a significant amount of political and cultural autonomy. There would be investment in that region. On paper, it really wasn't a bad agreement. But in fact, in reality, it didn't amount to hardly anything. Ryan Dawson.
They have rebelled again.
Well, the last time we talked, we went over one of those rebellions as well. And they have these cyclical rebellions, but if I got this right, because Mali's one of the, I don't know, fifth or sixth poorest countries in the world. It's a very poor country. And the situation you have there is a lot of men have been seeking work as military or bodyguards in places like Libya. And after Gaddafi fell, it was kind of like the Ronin in Japan, the Ronin, where you have basically a lot of trained armed military guys with no master and no one to pay them. And so naturally, you've kind of made this ripe grounds for the Saudis and their Wahhabi privateers to sort of hijack a rebellion that may have started on legit concerns and, you know, ethnic prejudice and repression. But once the Salafis get in there, it's a mess like in Syria.
Rob Prince. That's quite accurate. There are two themes here, two threads to develop. One, the Libyan threat is absolutely accurate. I don't know what the numbers are. I've not seen the numbers, but one number I saw was thousands of Malayans who served in the Libyan army. Okay, so Gaddafi, that whole thing collapses. And when it collapsed, these Malayan soldiers are blamed for Gaddafi's record, if you will. And there is a wave of anti-black racism. Nothing short of that. The result is that a lot of these former military elements, as you call them, Ronin, I like that you call them that, they fled. They flee to the Sahara, to southern Algeria, to the southwest corner of Libya itself, and to the northwest corner of Niger. These are well-trained, heavily armed military people. Now what is going to happen is first they energize the Azawad rebellion in the north. They more than energize it. They co-opt it very quickly. And they are run by these Islamist elements. So now this rebellion has a kind of military professionalism that it didn't have before. And the result of that is, given the weakness, interestingly enough, of the U.S.-trained Malayan military, they collapse in the face of that. The other interesting thing is, pretty much everybody in the region is Muslim. But the Azawad rebellion really is a secular rebellion. It's very much about social, economic, and cultural justice. But the rebellion is hijacked by these Islamist elements, and they go into two of Mali's historic cities, and they engage in what I call Salafist nonsense, which is important because it gives the French a pretext to intervene. That was the pretext right there. Ryan Dawson. I think we should point out, too, that these Islamists are not just random rebels. They have not-so-secret state sponsorship from Qatar and Saudi Arabia.
You know what?
Rob Prince. Yes. You know what? Okay. The problem is figuring out who is running who here. It's quite clear that there is Saudi money here in this rebellion, as there is everywhere in these rebellions. The purpose of that money is to hijack, or let's use another term, to divert what really has been the Arab Spring from its program, and they've been pretty good at doing that. But in any case, there are other intelligence agencies at work here, and they include the Algerians, who are very active in northern Mali. And until Gaddafi collapsed, also the Libyans were too. It's a global focus that is taking place in northern Mali of regional players and global players. And we've got these groups who are being funded by who knows who. I can trace some of it. I'm hesitant to point the finger beyond what we've just done, i.e. saying they are involved. But in fact, if you look at other places in Africa now, I think, for example, if you look at the never-ending conflict in Somalia, it's the same thing. Intelligence agencies of Western countries are actively supporting this group or that. It's really an integral part of modern counterinsurgency warfare in Africa. Sooner or later, we are going to be able to trace who is running whom. At this point, we can say with a certain amount of accuracy that there is no doubt that these Islamist groups are being funded from the outside. Ryan Dawson.
I hear what you're alluding to there, I think, because
as Ali North said, when we have plausible deniability, like, for example, when the U.S. was aiding the Contras, they always use a middleman. And so I often wonder, you don't have to say this, but I often wonder if some of these Saudis and Qatari groups aren't working in collusion sometimes because they have mutual benefits, and intelligence agencies, that's what they do. Well, don't destroy it, because we need those Wahhabi Salafists, you know, when the time's right, to come back and protect our resources. So why would you get rid of the problem completely when addressing the symptoms is perpetual profit for all these military industries and everything else?
Rob Prince, I agree with that 100%. Now, of course, proving that is something else, and you'll get accused of being conspiratorial or whatever. My point is, there are conspiracies out there. The hard thing is to figure out which ones are real and which ones aren't. But the fact that across the board, you look at the former French colonies in Africa, because that's what we're dealing with in this case, and what do you see economically? We see penetration by very, very large French corporations. We see very profitable enterprises as far as the bottom line and money is concerned. And yet we see virtually no development, none. And Mali, and neighboring Niger. Here's Niger, the world's great producers of uranium. And if Mali is one of the poorest countries in the world, Niger is right there with it in many ways. We also see certain other things, long-term patterns. Mali has had a window of democracy of sorts, but for the most part, we see dictatorship, we see depression, we see economic exploitation, and unending poverty in all these areas. Ryan Dawson.
Well, it's the old model of the banana republic, only it's uranium or oil or whatever instead of bananas, with an extra layer of these kind of proxy war mercenaries involved. And another good example of what you're saying, look at Afghanistan, billions, tens of billions of dollars spent, and where's the infrastructure? Where is it going? I mean, it's just a big sinkhole, other than the heroin. The money's just all going to the U.S. and its privateers, and it's not helping Afghanistan, and that was never the goal. So I'm pretty sinister in my beliefs when I think there is evidence of a conspiracy of sorts, because, yes, you can say the media say we're going there to liberate women or whatever, but in hindsight, that's never what happens, and all this money disappears, and where is it going?
Rob Prince. That's a good question. The way it is referred to in French literature is French Africa. It has different elements to it. One element is the economic exploitation and corporate penetration, but the other is the personal relationships that exist between the French government and military elements very high up and their African counterparts. For example, if you look at some of these French allies, it's very interesting. They're billionaires. Billionaires! So basically, the way it works is you get some partner, some African partners who you can cooperate with, and they basically get a cut in on the deal. And those systems, both the soft systems, and they have all these secret societies and silly, stupid secrets, but they're very excited when an African president becomes a member of this or that society. But those ties that bind the African French elite to France are very, very powerful. And then the other thing that you see is from time to time an African leader says, hey, this isn't working. For example, the last president of Mali, who, by the way, when it came to French corporate interests, was flexible. But he was nervous when what the French wanted him to do was give base rights. And he was nervous and said, no, I can't give you that. I can't give you that because I'm afraid there will be a pretext for Islamists in my country. Let's put it this way. When he was overthrown, there were no protests in France. The protests came when the military took over, who were supported by a leftist agenda and were supported by trade unions. Then the French got very nervous. I'm sure they weren't going to allow any kind of independent nationalist movement to take root. I'm sure it sent shivers down the spine of the French.
Ryan Dawson. That model you just described of basically bribing off sort of a local despot to go along with the plans is very reminiscent of Batista in Cuba, where the CIA was fine. They did not care at all how the conditions were in Cuba or the people who lived there, as long as the casinos were open and the money was flowing and all these U.S. corporate businesses could own like 99% of all the hotels there. Everything was fine. And then we know what happened after that. But the dictatorship or democracy or not, it doesn't really matter. All that really matters is whether or not they're politically efficable to U.S. interests or French interests or whatever the colonial power is. And this is we call neo-colonialism, but that's something I've heard you talk about too with with De Gaulle, the plan was to create economic dependence with France.
Rob Prince. The main themes of this French-African policy goes back to the 1950s. It goes back to De Gaulle. I find him to be one of the more interesting conservative leaders of the 20th century. To say that he was interesting does not mean that I agree with him. But he had a vision, he had a number of visions for France, and he worked on them, but he was also a realist. What he saw, he understood that the days of colonialism at the end of World War II were numbered. They were numbered for a whole series of reasons, and he understood that France's former African colonies would soon be independent. He saw that, with the exception of Algeria and Madagascar to a certain degree, he also understood that independence would threaten France's economic interests. So the guy that he sent down was the head of his political party, Jacques Foucart, F-O-C-C-A-R-T, and he was the architect of the French policy in post-colonial Africa. The bottom line was simple. Oh yeah, political independence, but we are going to fight tooth and nail to retain the economic structures that were set up in the colonial period, the dependence on France. It's been a very successful venture from France's point of view, but it's been very incredibly cruel and oppressive for the people of Africa. I suppose the reason French people, with a few exceptions, support all these are because they benefit from it. Ryan Dawson. I wonder how much they really do, though. How much they really benefit. It seems like certain companies and all benefit, but it usually doesn't trickle down.
Rob Prince. Of course not. You know, right. It's true. But the general prosperity, that is raised, just as the same as the United States, who benefits from third world countries. The same is true for France. They benefit from exploiting third world countries. I don't know. The U.S., I don't know about France, but in the U.S.'s case, they're spending trillions of dollars on these imperial escapades, and though the top benefit, I think the general welfare of the public is actually lessened because they have higher prices for oil in the long run.
Rob Prince.
This is true. In preparation for our talk, I was reading the responses of the French Parliament to extending the military intervention in Mali, and across the board, left and right, they supported it. The Communist Party, they didn't support it, they abstained, but they would not oppose it. I agree generally with what you were saying. Of course the French people don't benefit from it, but they think they do. There's this ability to pull these nationalist strings, and it's what's happening in France.
I think you're absolutely right, and what I'm trying to do with this kind of media, too, is explain to people, the war supporters or people who secretly support war or kind of, they don't speak out against it because they think, well, I want the benefits from it, that you're not getting benefits. You're actually losing treasury. Plus, it's immoral. But I mean, if that doesn't bother you, you're not actually benefiting. You're actually hurting your own nation in a general level. And you're just letting some plutocrats get a little bit wealthier. And that's all, really. And you're destroying the lives of millions. But our time's running. I'll have to come you back. I'd like to have you back on to talk about Central Africa. It's a whole other topic, and I know you were getting ready to get into it earlier, and I sort of diverted the conversation, but... same thing, different area, right?
Rob Prince. Well, you know, much of what we said, because frankly, you know a heck of a lot, I can say about Central Africa. Many of the same themes are at work. How deep it goes, I'd like to look more closely at. But this is part of Libya, Mali, Central Africa. It's remilitarization under new conditions. It's about finding a way to legitimize a permanent presence. Oh, well, thank you for your time. I always learn a lot from you, and I'll have you back in the future, and keep blogging, I'll keep reading, and we'll try and get this information out and do the best we can. So thank you very much.
Take care. Bye-bye.